10-1, episode 205, A Baptist Catholic Dialogue 2, Eucharist featuring Judd Baroff. Welcome to 10-1. And we'll be talking, I'm going to switch right over. Not a lot to say here at the start, except that this podcast is also available as a video on YouTube, so you can check the show links if you want to see the video instead of just listening to the audio. Otherwise, we're going to do the introduction and the prefatory material over there. So enjoy. All right. Here we are back again. With the return of Judd Baroff. Welcome back, Judd. It's been 11 episodes since you were on. That's the speed we podcast at. So
11 episodes in almost as many months.
Yeah. So if you haven't heard episode 193, A Baptist Catholic Dialogue featuring Judd Baroff, you can go back and watch the video for that or listen to the podcast. Had a really good conversation there. So we're going to do it again. And this is spinning out from how we ended our conversation last time, and because of that conversation, I picked up this book, Transubstantiation, Theology, History, and Christian Unity by Dr. Brett Sockold, and that took me, I think, a few months to work through because I was taking a lot of notes. I ended up with 15 pages of notes or something, and So I spent 50 minutes on the previous episode trying to give a narration of that book, and really enjoyed the book. Go back and listen to that episode if you want to dive into a shallow dive of that material. But what I didn't say in at the end of that, saving it for here, was my takeaway. And I don't think it's going to be a surprise because I think I've said this before. I don't view myself, and I don't think other Baptists or people in other churches, but I think this is probably more of a Baptist thing. I don't think we should come into like a study of theology as like empty spreadsheets where we have to like figure out our preferences and like which checkboxes are we going to check for each possible different theology. We are all within traditions, and so I definitely want to like be aware of the history and the boundaries of the tradition that I'm in, and not just like, well, I just feel like it's this actually, and just kind of swim outside my lane, I suppose. I guess boundaries for Baptist thought seem to be, it was very close to Calvin's, idea of the Eucharist to start. And then, there's some discussion on why this shifted, but it may be just the spirit of the age of the rationalism that came in the early 1700s. It shifted into this the Zwingli view of it's a kind of a bear symbol. Although again, he doesn't get into Zwingli much in this book. Just and some people dispute it, how much Zwingli thought it was just symbolic. Leaving all that aside, Baptists today are very much is just a symbol. That's the going opinion. And so it was really interesting to from Dr. Sockold's perspective here. Like here's where Calvin was like intersecting with Aquinas, and here's where he differed. Because I guess that would be like the real presence view that's within my tradition. So what do you think? Does that make sense, I guess?
I think so. I think when we talked last time, and I'm going to do it again right here, I want to make clear that, you know, neither of us, but especially not me, nope, are theologians. And yep, you know, and I...
Two guys.
Bishop Barron, who's a pretty famous and forward bishop of the church because he has the Word on Fire, which is an evangelical, in our sense, ministry. And he talks about how, you know, he tells stories about how he brings up in the bishops' conference how there really needs to be some control, not control exactly, but certification is perhaps too strong. But for books that are used in Catholic education, there's this stamp, and I've just spaced out the name of it because I'm being recorded, so of course I'm going to space out the name of it. And it says that this book has been checked over by the bishops and it conforms with Catholic teaching. And so then therefore it can be used in Catholic schools to teach theology and things like that. And he was saying podcasters, those who hold themselves out as experts at least, should go through a similar process. I not only did not go through such a process, but I'm not holding myself out to be an expert. I mean, there is no process to go through, so I couldn't have. But even so, and even less of an expert am I in sort of the various Protestant distinctions. And so it was fascinating when I was listening to your last podcast, when you were breaking down sort of the differences between Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. Am I getting that name right?
Mm-hmm. All right.
Because it's
Zwingli.
So, because it sounded to me like Luther and Calvin were very close to a Catholic understanding of what the Eucharist is, and that was surprising to me. Not necessarily because I thought they were, you know. I mean, just because I guess I didn't know anything. You know, I don't even know what I thought. I was trying to find something. But no, I had, you know, someone had asked me, well, what was their view on it? And I'm like, I guess they didn't think it was the real presence, but I'm not sure. But it sounds like they basically did, even if we can, you know, we can get eventually to maybe to transubstantiation versus consubstantiation. But, you know, fundamentally, if you would ask them, well, do you believe in the real presence? It sounds like they would have said yes. Asked us to define our terms.
Yeah, no, they both would have said yes. And I don't think I read the quote in the previous episode. I don't have it pulled up, but Luther said something like, I would rather drink blood with the Pope than drink wine with the Zwinglians, with the with the heretics, I think he called them, or the extremists. I don't remember what he calls them.
Okay, but he
saw himself as closer to the Roman Catholic view. I mean, obviously, he was a Roman Catholic until he was excommunicated.
Well, everyone was a Roman Catholic.
Well, yeah, everyone in this conversation. he doesn't. That is one interesting thing. There's no discussion at all about the East.
Yeah,
no Eastern theologians in here. So I'm sure they would tell a slightly different story. But to the degree that they come up, it is to say they never had a Luther.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to put on paper or some of the things that.
Yeah.
That there doesn't have to be a Council of Trent if there's not a Martin Luther.
Exactly. Actually, in conversations with Orthodox, this comes up because they have distinctions that Catholics sort of never consider. Like there's this energy distinction that they make that essence versus energies, and it's just not something that comes up in Catholicism. And it turns out that they had someone in like the 10th or 12th century who. sort of started a movement which contradicted, you know, their understanding, the orthodox small o, the orthodox orthodox, small and big, understanding of the essence and nature of God. And so they wrote it down. And there was just, it seems, at least from my perspective, and they might tell me I'm wrong and list, you know, dozens, so maybe I am wrong, I have no idea. But it seems from my perspective that because there wasn't the quite such a, there wasn't the Reformation, there wasn't a whole series of people trying to argue against what, you know, traditional Catholic understanding of these things, that a lot less has been written down in that sense. But again, there are things written down on the Orthodox side, which Catholics haven't considered because we haven't had to face. That's just a very interesting happenstance. And it's good to think about when having conversations with the Orthodox, not that we're about to here, but...
Right.
But one of the things your narration of the book really made me think was that in some ways the Orthodox were wise. I mean, again, it wasn't really, they weren't really planning it, but they were wise in that there's a lot they haven't defined, and it allows, it doesn't, I mean, maybe that strikes people as wrong. Well, shouldn't you be precise? But... Mm.
I think some to be precise. Yeah.
And I think sometimes there's a lot you can convey with metaphor that logic chopping doesn't assist you with.
Right. Yeah, and certainly I'm, you know, very grateful for the theologians and the the scholars, but for like the guy in the pew, the analogy and the metaphor is going to be what's going to be more important.
Yeah.
Or like that's how you teach, I guess. So you made me think of something, but now it's escaped me. You had asked me a question about to clarify something I said about what Aquinas said about do we chew Christ with our teeth?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to try and do a better job of putting that into words?
Sure, and then maybe
explain kind of what. Like, why'd that give you pause?
Sure, and I'll get to that in one second. I just want to recount something from Boethius. In a letter to he might be a saint, I don't know, but Pope John the First, he said, and I only have it down in Latin, and my Latin's not great, so I'm going to translate it as best I can on air, which is going to be awkward. It's faith. As far as possible, and reason conjoined. So it's faith and reason as far as possible, but faith. He was sort of the founder of the Scholastic movement. The Scholastic movement, at least until sort of the end there, when it got a little reason heavy, was very big about saying we are going to explain the mysteries as far as we can, but we will never fully explain the mysteries. And I really like that, and that's why it's in my commonplace book, and why I can pick it up in, you know, 5 seconds.
That is really good. That does make me. So one of the questions I had reading the book was, that Dr. Sokol does, I think, a good job of explaining that transubstantiation is a description, or maybe even, I don't even know if he says description, but it's not an explanation. It's just the term for what happens, And it's still a mystery, even with as much as you know, you can go read reams and reams or volumes and volumes of books about it, of course. But I wonder, how do you decide where the boundaries are, I guess, of what's mystery and what then you have to try and explain? I certainly understand something like a Berengarius or a Martin Luther comes along and you want to so if you've got a figure that is teaching against what the church teaches, you've got to protect your people against that. So I see that. I wonder, is that the only, or I guess that's one of the major thoughts that you have versus, you know, because there's something like, I think I threw it out in passing. No one, none of the figures in this book really explain the ascension. You know, completely. There's still a lot of mystery of what does it mean that Christ is locally present in heaven? Like, it's not a place in outer space. But then what does that mean if we say it's not just metaphorical?
It has neither place or time, so how can he be physically present into it? No, exactly.
Yeah, so that
unless there is a place in space and time that's sort of a pre-second coming heaven, and then the heaven of which, as we understand it, God lives, although, you know, God existed before existence, you know, and then everything falls apart because you're talking as a creature who has only known space and time, who's very construction down to the atom is within a place of space and time, and you're trying to talk about the eternal, which happened, and I'll go back to Boethius. Boethius has this beautiful line, which my faint memory of it in English is going to butcher, because in Latin it's just beautiful. And he says it's time is not an infinite extension of present moments. It's the simultaneous, he doesn't say conception.
Like apprehension?
Simultaneous achievement of all time. So it's sort of, the metaphor I love and I fall back on all the time is, if you finish a wonderful book and you sit back and let it, all of it hit you at once, that you are in infinity, in eternity, not infinity, excuse me. You're in eternity of the book's time.
Yeah. I do love that passage. And that is a really good analogy. Right. So then, I guess, is it... there's not like a rule for when something's explainable.
I think you just have to explain, you know, the human, you know, humanity doesn't really live by rules, and we don't live as one corporate body, not, you know, partially because we're not properly incorporated into Christ yet. An individual can only do what he can do. And so really the question is, what are you going to do about it? And then that's understand and explain as best as I possibly can. And that's all I can do. And that's, you know, Aquinas can do a whole lot more of that than I can, but there's still a limit to his ability.
True, right.
And so he can only explain as best as he is able to. You know, that's why Christ says being a teacher, you know, he doesn't say it quite like this. This is my paraphrase, but is, you know, one of the most soul imperiling things one can do, because you are always a moment away from giving your student, or from parent to child, the same thing, especially for we who homeschool. You're always just a moment away from giving a student or giving your child a completely wrong impression about the nature of reality that will be impossible for him to kick for the rest of his life. You know, it's a dangerous thing to do. And we've got completely off topic, but I mean, it's tangentially related.
Yeah, no, that is good.
For those at home, this is how Brian's and my conversations usually go. We're trying to stick to a schedule. We are failing.
No. I'm all truth is God's truth. So all side trails are in play. That makes me think a lot about a lot of homeschooling and parenting stuff. But yes, it is a heavy responsibility, and there is danger, but it is definitely worth it.
Oh yeah.
What else was I going to say? You made me think about something. I think what I was thinking also with that was, pressure's off because we're just two guys. and I'm glad that there are theologians like Dr. Sockold that are doing this sort of ecumenical discussions. And I think, like what you were saying, as far as we just do the best we can do, each individual does the best they can do. I think that is at the end of the day. I don't feel like I have to solve any of this, or certainly don't have to convince anyone else, since I can't even convince myself exactly where I am on a lot of things. So I wanted to say thank you, because I appreciate these conversations, and I think they are helpful for mapping out where the borders are, and I think they're helpful. They're certainly fun.
Yes, they're definitely a lot of fun, and good, you know. Even if we never convince each other, that's not really the goal. The goal is to gain clarity for ourselves through the dialogue.
Yes. So. Yeah, I have no desire to change your mind on this one. Okay, so the question about... Do our teeth chew Christ? I think was the phrase that came up.
Well, I could run, and I think because we'll get there naturally, I think I could run through sort of why I think everyone should believe in the real presence. Then I think one of the things I bring up will naturally lead to that question. Because I'm not sure what Aristotle, I'm not sure what Aquinas means.
Close enough.
And to the degree I had a impression of what we were doing, my impression contradicts what I think he means. But of course, as I don't know.
Yeah. You know. Well, and I think all these guys are like nuancing and like trying with language to
get there. Exactly.
So why don't you start, and then we'll get there.
So I think the place that really hit me, where I was just like, okay, yeah, I'm convinced, is we see Christ throughout the New Testament explaining in parable, explaining in symbol. You know, I am the door, as you used from Zwingli. I'm sorry.
I'm a Zwingli fan, so it's okay.
Well, I mean, I heard his name you know, 2 days ago. So,
yeah.
sorry to the Protestants listening, but I am really not versed in Protestant history. Christ continually brings up metaphor and symbol throughout in his parables and in his teachings. And again, we see people failing to understand him. You know, there's the, and I'm looking over here because I thought I had it, but it doesn't seem to exist anymore. There's a place there, well, there was a specific place in Matthew I was going to put our attention, but I can't remember what it was, so it doesn't matter that much. But he will always stop and go, you know, okay, what I really mean is this, or, you know, mm-hmm. even you are not understanding what I mean is this. And so there is simply one place, and as far as I know, only one place in the Gospels, where he does not do that move. I mean, sometimes he just explains the parable, moves on, and no one questions him. But, you know, in terms of no people do not understand, there's only one place where he doesn't go, at least to the apostles, here's what I mean. And that's in John 6, which in the Catholic Church is known as the Bread of Life Discourse. I don't know if it's known that way throughout Protestant churches.
I've heard that.
Okay. So it's the Bread of Life Discourse, and where John 6 is fascinating in the way it's built up, because he feeds the people in one of the multiplication of the loaves and fishes. This is where the little boy brings him the barley loaves, and he multiplies the barley loaves. And again, sort of like the wedding at Cana, you know, he gets the most basic ingredients. A barley loaf is like the most basic bread you could have. Water is, okay. of course, the most basic drink. And he turns it into something that is heavenly. I mean, literally, of course, but also just adjectively. And so, you know, the steward says this is the best wine. And all the people say this is the best bread they've ever tasted. Things like that. Then they try to make him king, and of course he is, but they're trying to make him king the wrong way. And so he flees from them. And then the next thing it shows is he's up on the top of a mountain, and he comes down to the sea, and he makes the sea do something that we would call unnatural. He walks on water. He can walk on water, and so he controls the elements. And only then do we get the Bread of Life Discourse. All the people wake up, they see that he's not there, they get into boats, they cross the lake, they sit down, and then he talks about the Bread of Life Discourse, where he says, you know, the only people who can have life is to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And the word he uses really is flesh. And something I skipped is before that they ask him, well, could you give us more bread? That was delicious. Then when he says no, they say, well, do you have the manna from heaven? Which is their way of asking, are you the Messiah? Because the Messiah is supposed to bring them the manna of heaven. And so that's when he gives them the Bread of Life Discourse. And I'll come back to this section because there's an interesting linguistic thing that happens, which gets us to the chewing on Christ's body point.
Okay. Yep.
But I just want to bring up two sources outside. So obviously we go, the whole point of that passage before I just dropped the ball. So he says, you have to chew, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And they say, what is this? How are you going to give us your flesh, Dee? What are you talking about? And a lot of them go away. And he doesn't say, stop, guys. It's just a symbol. Come back. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about, you know, we're talking symbolically here, people. You know, I'm not really a door. I'm not really a sheep. I'm not really a shepherd. Come mm-hmm. on, you know how this works. He doesn't say that. Mm-hmm. He turns to his disciples and says, are you going to leave me too?
Mm.
And they go, well, I mean, you have the word of life. Mm. You know, where else would we go?
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that they're completely befuddled too, but he doesn't explain it to them either. He just leaves it.
True.
Again, he can explain it, if not to all of his followers, then at least to his disciples, if not all of his disciples, then at least to the apostles. And he doesn't do any of those. He just leaves it. So that, to me, was pretty darn convincing, but there's a couple other things that happened. So there's a letter we have preserved from, I would say, St. Ignatius of Antioch. So for those who don't know, he died circa 108. We're not entirely sure. He was the patriarch of Antioch, so obviously fairly high up as these things go. He, at least by tradition, is a companion and student of St. John the Apostle. So the beloved disciple is his teacher, and he writes in letters right before his death, sort of to different churches in the way St. Paul did. And one of the things he says, he's talking against a heresy at the time called Docetism. I'm probably not pronouncing that right. But they believed that Christ didn't physically come back from the dead. They believed what the apostles saw was an apparition. And of course, to me, that seems to make mockery of the story of Doubting Thomas. You know, you're not putting your fingers into the wounds of an apparition. But leaving that aside, we're not here to talk about heresies, at least not this one. Just
heresy.
And so, you know, what he says to them is, and this is a quotation,
the Eucharist. Hold up. My thing is doing weird things. Can you hear me?
I can still hear you.
Okay.
Actually, so sounds better.
Oh, okay. Well, then we'll just leave it. So one of the things they say is they abstain from the Eucharist and from prayer because they confess not the Eucharist to be the flesh of our Savior Jesus Christ, which suffered for our sins and which the Father of his goodness raised up again. So here's the question to me is why would a group who didn't believe that Jesus has been physically raised from the dead, why would they care about the Eucharist, taking the Eucharist, if the people giving it to them were not telling them that this is the literal body and blood of Christ? If it was just a symbol, it wouldn't upset them. They would be saying, okay, it's just a symbol. I can, you know, deal symbolically with this. But instead, St. Ignatius, and again, this is like the first, basically, generation of Christians after Christ. One of the first writings we have is saying, hey, look, this is the, you know, the body and blood. This is the real thing. And the whole area, you know, he does that, you know, he says that sort of again and again and again. It isn't just a one-off. This is just the most clear example. Likewise, I know I'm monologuing a little bit, but if you allow me to continue that. So Saint Cyril of who was Bishop of Jerusalem in the first century after the Council of Nicaea, he left behind catechetical letters where he is talking about, you know, the various sort of things that you need to believe and things you should be teaching the people who are coming into the church. And again, you know, this is the Bishop of Jerusalem. It's not exactly a, you know, piddling post. This is right after the Council of Nicaea. So all of Christendom is at least theoretically on the same page. And he says, and I'm going to read the first six sections of this letter, the very short sections. Even of itself, the teaching of the Blessed Paul is sufficient to give you a full assurance concerning those defined mysteries. For those who want to look it up, I think it's the seventh letter.
Okay.
And I can send you, Brian, all the links to this.
Okay. Yeah, we'll put those in the show notes then.
So full assurance concerning those defined mysteries, of which, having been deemed worthy, you have become of the same body and blood with Christ. For you have just heard him say distinctly that our Lord Jesus Christ, in the night in which he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body." And having taken the cup and given thanks, he said, "Take, drink, this is my blood." Since then he himself declared and said of the bread, "This is my body," who shall dare to doubt any longer? And since he himself affirmed and said, "This is my blood," who shall ever hesitate saying that is not his blood? This is section two. He once in Cana of Galilee turned the water into wine akin to blood. And is it incredible that he should have turned wine into blood? Mm-hmm. When called to a bodily marriage, he miraculously wrought that wonderful work. And on the children of the bride, on the children of the bride chamber, he cites Matthew 9:15. Shall he not much rather be acknowledged to have bestowed the fruition of his body and blood? 3. Wherefore, with full assurance, let us partake as of the body and blood of Christ. For in the figure of bread is given to you his body, and in the figure of wine his blood, that you, by partaking of the body and blood of Christ, may be made of the same body and of the same blood with him. For thus we come to bear Christ in us, because his body and his blood are distributed through our members. Thus it is that, according to the blessed Peter, we become partakers of the divine nature. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4. Mm-hmm. 4. Christ, on a certain occasion, discoursing with the Jews, said, "Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you." John 6:53. They, not having heard his saying in the spiritual sense, were offended and went back, supposing that he was inviting them to eat flesh. In the Old Testament also there was showbread, but this, as it belonged to the Old Testament, has come to an end. But in the New Testament there is bread of heaven and a cup of salvation, sanctifying soul and body. For as the bread corresponds to our body, so is the word appropriate to our soul. 6 and last. Thank you for your patience. Consider, therefore, the bread and the wine not as bare elements, for they are, according to the Lord's declaration, the body and blood of Christ. For even though sense suggests this to you, yet let faith establish you. Judge not the matter from the taste, but from faith be fully assured without misgivings that the body and blood of Christ have been vouchsafed to you. There was something else I wanted to... Oh, then here it is. So there was an idea, and I'm getting some of this stuff, that last letter and what I'm about to say, either from Scott Hahn's The Last Supper or from Brand Petra's Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist. So there was an idea that when the new Moses would come, and I think all traditions understand Christ as the new Moses, or as a, you know, fulfillment of Moses, there would be a parousia. There would be a the Messiah would take the Jews not up to Mount Horeb to have a feast as they did in Exodus, but take them up to Mount Sion, so all can see God face to face and all can be in his presence. The word for presence is parousia. That's the Greek. which we now associate with the second coming, but it really just means the presence. And Christ says that, the old idea was that with the destruction of the second temple and the establishment of the third, the establishment of the heavenly Jerusalem, there would be all the family of God would come into his presence. And there is both, in various ways, the Catholic Church and the Orthodox churches believe that and teach that in the Mass you are in the presence of God, and the Mass is this fulfillment, just as Christ during this Last Supper took three goblets of wine, where in a traditional Seder you're supposed to take four goblets of wine. And we know where he took the fourth goblet of wine. He took it on the cross, right at the fulfillment of the Passover sacrifice. Because the lamb, now there's some idea that maybe the lamb itself was crucified during the Passover sacrifice. This is, again, I'm getting from those two books I mentioned. I don't know anything about that besides what I read in the books. But the Passover sacrifice was broken up into, five requirements. They weren't really conceived of in quite that way. They're just five parts, maybe. So they chose an unblemished male lamb in its prime. They sacrificed the lamb. And again, specifically in Jesus and the Jewish roots of the Eucharist, he talks about how that lamb was crucified, carried from the temple on a cross, at least. Not really crucified in the way, Christ was, but carried from the temple on a cross. The blood was spread of the lamb as a sign of the sacrifice. It was kept as a Passover of remembrance for all of eternity. And then the part everyone misses is that at the end of the sacrifice, the flesh of the lamb was eaten. And then I guess the last thing that will stop my monologue and take us into what you brought up about Aquinas is that there is also an interesting move that the end of John 6, the Bread of Life discourse, does. So, and I looked at this last night, because I can decipher, even though I can't read Greek. And it says, Christ uses the very normal word for eating throughout the entire thing. It's the word from which we get, like an autophage, a self eater. Phagon, I think, is the third, is one specific tense of it that he uses over and over and over again. But at a certain point in John, it's John 53, I want to say. I know I wrote it down. Yes, John 53. It changes from phagete, which is the normal, just eating, the regular eating version, to trogon, which is what animals do. It's gnawing on flesh and bone. And that's why I was like, wait a second. What is Aquinas talking about here? Because that's not how I conceived of it, because I knew this distinction, even if I hadn't traced it down. And so he makes that move. He's like being, and that's why the people are walking away, because it's like he is being as literal and visceral and in some ways disgusting as he possibly can be to try to get this point across. And with all of that, and you're just going to tell me, well, I'm not convinced, and that's fine. But it's, I almost don't know how else to think of it at that point.
Yeah. Right. So then the question, so like I could present that in the Sunday school class I'm going to be teaching next month. And the first question that I know I'll get will be, then how is it not cannibalism? Like what is different here that makes it not cannibalism? And Aquinas has an answer for that. And the others have an answer for that. But like what, like there is something different. It's not like a chemical change, right? Or a,
yeah. Well, so this isn't the first thing I have to say isn't going to directly answer that. And the second thing I have to say is, but will probably be unsatisfying. So the first thing I have to say is, look, if God can be both man and God, I don't know why, you know, what looks to us to be a wafer cannot be Christ. Mm-hmm. The second answer is why isn't it, to what, and to the question why isn't it cannibalism is, I don't know.
Okay.
yeah. I don't really, you know, given that Christ commanded it, I don't really care. I mean, and that, right. that's you know, facile, that's sort of insulting, you know, but I'd be interested to hear what Aquinas has to say, but it's not something that keeps me up at night, I guess is really what I mean by the I don't care comment. You know, right. Christ commands it, so I'm going to do it.
Right. No, that is a good, like, end of the day answer, for sure. And I think that's what Luther was saying, like, well, if it's... if that's what it means, then that's what I'm going to do. Rather yeah. that, then it's just a metaphor.
Yeah. Well, so, and then not Dorothy Sayers. Sorry, she was a Catholic. Flannery O'Connor,
famously
says, you know, if it's just a symbol or just a metaphor, then to hell with it.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I realized that. That I had mentioned this to you before we started recording, so I should have brought this up sooner. But I do I do agree that there is that Christ is really present. I don't think I could articulate very well to, again, when I'm teaching the Sunday school class to. Somebody that is just going to go with the common Baptist understanding today, which is that it's a metaphor, it's a symbol, and it is a symbol and it is a metaphor, but the real presence view would be that there's more than that.
The word just is the problem we have, not the symbol right. part.
For sure. I don't know how to articulate why it's important that it be not just a symbol. Obviously, if that's the truth, then the truth is important.
Yeah.
If that's what there's the argument of, I think basically, I don't know if there are any exceptions even before Zwingli said it was only a metaphor. So there's the argument of you've got church history for, you know, 1500 years. So I understand not wanting someone to you know, make innovations, but just like purely would somebody that didn't understand, not even understand, because again, I don't know that anyone understands it, but like, I suppose it's the with food, I guess, as an analogy, barely an analogy, with food, you get all of the nutrition, even if you don't understand why the food is nutritious. It's the act of eating that feeds you, not the understanding. So I guess I'm not arguing that it doesn't matter, or that the church should allow both views or anything like that. I guess I just have a hard time articulating what would be the difference between, maybe this would be easiest. Let's say there's a Roman Catholic in good standing that's confused because, for whatever reason, they've been talking to their Baptist neighbor and they're confused. And they think that it's a metaphor, but they go to Mass and they take the Eucharist. Is there a difference for that person with their faulty understanding, do you think?
This is way beyond my pay grade.
Yeah. Yeah, that's maybe one for the priests and the pastors.
I will say that I'm not going to give numbers because I don't know what it is, but there is a terrifyingly high percentage of Catholics who don't believe in the real presence. And I bet most of them don't think the church teaches it. It's not like I was about to say being heretical on purpose, but I'm not sure you can be heretical on accident or by accident. Like, I think you have to be purposeful about these things. Again, this is sort of above my pay grade. If this is you and you are a Catholic, go talk to your priest is the advice I have.
To defend those folks in that poll to some degree, I think there are some that probably don't believe in the real presence, and also some that are probably confused by the wording in the polls and are maybe thinking, well, I know it's not chemically flesh. If I put it under a microscope, it still is bread chemically to some. I don't know how we want to phrase it, but it still tastes like bread.
I think that's right. That's definitely a traditional Catholic understanding, with the exception. And I would suggest that people are interested, they go check these out, because they're fascinating exceptions. The Eucharistic miracles are all over the place, and they're very interesting. Someone who is by nature incredibly skeptical about these sorts of things. There's a lot of them that I just like, okay, I'm won over. I'm blown away. This isn't confusion. This isn't an accident. This isn't, I don't know any, unless it's rampant lying, and it isn't, because hundreds of people see it, some of them anyway. Mm-hmm. And the church is very guarded against fakery, because there has been a lot of it. And so the church is very skeptical and can be actually quite antagonistic to anyone claiming a miracle of any sort, but especially a Eucharistic miracle. You can get people who get very upset at you in the church hierarchy, or not upset at you necessarily, but like,
yeah,
well, what were you doing? Who was with you? Where trying to establish everything to make sure you're not just putting a hoax over Mother Church. And so some of these, you just read them, though, and you're just blown away. And so excluding the Eucharist of Miracles, I don't think there's any Catholic I know, at least, who would say, no, yeah, you're going to find, you know, genetic flesh underneath that microscope. That's not, that is part of the right. accidents that you were talking about in the last episode. Aquinas right. distinguishes.
Right. And so for the question of, do you chew Christ with your teeth?
Mm-hmm.
I think where he's, well, okay. So the specific question he was trying to answer was, I think, do we hurt Christ when we chew the Eucharist?
Okay.
And so part of it was he's saying it's an asymmetrical, we don't affect Christ.
Yeah.
He's not, when you pick up the bread and the wine, he's not moving from one place to another.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It doesn't hurt him to chew on him.
No, and I think that's related to the Catholic understanding of the Mass. You talked about it a little bit, I think, again, last episode, and I forget exactly what you said, even though I wanted to write it down and bring it up here.
Okay.
Because while what you said was right, I think the way you phrased it, because you don't, you know, yeah, it might just be a little confusing. The yeah. Catholic understanding of Mass is that, I was almost going to say, and this goes back to the Boethius problem, it's impossible to talk about this. I was almost going to say that every Mass is happening at the same time, but that's not it. It's every Mass is a participation in eternity.
Yeah.
So at those moments, you blow apart all these distinctions of, you know, temporality and time. You know, you can't move Christ in the middle of eternity like that. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just true. There. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more of a light bulb situation, an on or an off. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, if you want to get niggling about this, you can say, well, actually, technically, you're moving the light particles as you stop it. you know, metaphors are imprecise by nature, otherwise, they'd simply be descriptions.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. It's also, and I didn't bring this out because I had to leave a lot out to get it under an hour of he's talking about in that section concomitants, which is his answer for so Aquinas is going to say, and this is in question 76 of the Summa, that that it's the whole Christ that's present.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to say it's not, you know, it's not his hand that's there, but the rest of his body is not present. So his whole present is there. He does say something like his flesh is present in the bread in a different way than the whole Christ is present in the bread, and the whole and his whole body is present in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, where you sometimes have the practice of just taking one kind, or it's okay to have.
Yeah. Communion under one species. It's very common. Especially after COVID is my understanding, because, you know, no longer were people quite so thrilled about everyone drinking out of one cup.
Right. I'm sure they're already a little squidgy on that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Catholic teaching is that every molecule, every atom, every smallest part of each substance is body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. So that is what you're taking, whether you take into one species or two, whether you get the full wafer or cut broken in half, you are taking the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah, and that matches with... I don't remember where it was, but I think it was probably Aquinas saying it's not just Christ's soul present with the bread and wine as his body. So yeah, I mean, it definitely gets into a lot of very detailed or descriptions, like circling the mystery, I guess. I don't know if there's much more here that I'm not just going to sit and read this. I was going to
I sat here and read for a while earlier, so, you know.
Yeah, so I guess the part where he gets to with the teeth, let's see if I can skip forward to that part. Right, okay, so this is in the section where he's talking about local presence, and Aquinas says Christ is not locally present in the sacrament, which again, I mean, you could like spend all of your time defining terms over and over, but he said Christ is locally present in heaven, not locally present in the sacrament. And then his dimensions are not present. So he separated out dimensions from accidents, and said it's the dimensions of the bread that are present and the wine. And then, yeah, this is when he got into he's not present in a mobile way, so he can't be moved. Right. He does talk in here about Eucharistic miracles. Like you were saying, he says that is separate, because part of the, I guess, normal Eucharist is that it is the substance that changes, not the accidents.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so then, I guess that's his explanation for that. He's saying he's not local. So, right. So we cannot suffer whatever happens to the host. So I guess I don't have any more to add than what I already said. So,
well, and this is where we go, you know, this is why I should say, to give the Orthodox churches their due. This is why a lot of them are skeptical of the Catholic churches, and it gets, if I do say so myself, cranked up to 11 a bit in Protestants. But the need for a rational definition of reality. And so, you know, well, I can't, obviously, I can speak for them even less well than I can speak for the Catholic Church, which I can't speak for. I have heard Orthodox say that this is why they don't even get into the messy problem of defining these all, because you just trip yourself up and take your eye away from what's important, which is the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, as sort of laid out by you know, by the early church fathers and by Christ himself.
Yeah.
Which I'm sympathetic to that, even though I also am sympathetic to Boethius's, you know, faith and reason together to the extent possible.
Right. Right.
And then faith.
Yeah. Yeah. That is it at the end of the day. Okay. Well, was there anything else that you wanted to dip into? I know, at the risk of starting another hour of, but I feel like we covered a chunk there. Why don't you, we can either go into another route, or we can head to a wrap up.
Well, you tell me what this does. I just think this is funny because I was looking up the some of the terms that I didn't really know. Like, I'd heard consubstantiation versus transubstantiation, but I really didn't know what that meant. And I found a little sort of joke almost in an article that was trying to define them, which is it's transubstantiation, not consubstantiation, because consubstantiation would be a new incarnation. And the whole point is that the Eucharist is an extension of the incarnation. It's not a new one. So as this guy phrased it, Christ is fully man and fully divine. He isn't fully man, fully divine, and fully pastry.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you want to pick that up and run with it or just leave it there, but I thought that was a clever distinction and you know, useful in our case.
Yeah, one of the and I think I don't quite understand the explanation, because I think Luther was the only one out of Aquinas, Calvin, Zwingli, and Luther. Luther was the only one to say that Christ is omnipresent. And so he was saying at the ascension, he was saying the ascension is a metaphor for Christ becoming omnipresent. And the others did not agree with that. So Aquinas doesn't think that Christ is omnipresent. He thinks he's locally present in heaven, whatever that means. But he says, in the same way that you were saying, Christ cannot move, if he's outside of time and space, then Aquinas is also saying that consubstantiation would require him to move, so he's not somewhere, and then he's not with the bread, and now he moves to the bread.
Okay. Yeah. No, I see that. That makes sense too.
And Aquinas says it's more like he's already there. He's already at each point of creation, not in a pantheistic way, because God is separate from creation, but in a, I don't know if there's a better analogy than the person reading the book or the person outside the book. But he is already there, and when the substance of the bread is removed, the substance of Christ remains, but it was already there.
Yeah.
Kind of. So I don't know then what the distinction is to say Christ is not omnipresent. I wish I could have like a Luther and Aquinas, here to argue that in Latin, and then you could translate it for me.
No, I couldn't. I definitely read Aquinas to the extent I read Aquinas at all in translation.
Yeah.
I cannot do that. That's interesting, because I think pantheism would say we are all a part of God, but of course the whole Christian story is that we have separated ourselves from God and we're trying through, in the Catholic case, the sacraments, but ultimately with our death and with God's grace to reunite with God. And so clearly we are separate from, but
right.
To the, this is a problem, I think, in part because we have this, we are all materialists in the modern world, even those of us who are trying to separate ourselves from materialism. And so the idea of that the bread and wine could change their substance without changing their materiality does not make sense to us.
All right, quick break and we're back for the wrap up.
We were interrupted by a child. So what I was saying was that we were all materialists in this modern world, however much some of us try not to be. And so we have no conception of something. We have no theoretical conception of something changing without the underlying materiality of it changing. And so the idea that the wafer could become, the bread and wine could become the body and blood of Christ without it actually changing materiality doesn't make much sense. But there are very special, very reserved areas of life where we still understand this. So I'm going to take the more controversial one first, and that is in marriage. In marriage, you go up as two separate people, pledge yourselves to each other, and you are then one person at that moment. You are a single individual. Now, of course, we understand, you know, especially in a modern the legal realm, because we are materialists, we have separated out these people completely and legally and in our modern world. But sacramentally, we are meant to understand us as one person. And legally, before the modern era, that was absolutely the case. You know, to the point where you could legally force each other to do certain things that are demanded within the marriage state.
I'm tracking.
Another and less controversial aspect is contracts. If I present you, Brian, a contract, it is just a piece of paper with some ink on it until the moment you sign it. And then it is something completely different. Then it is a contract. And materially, it is all the same. Now, you can argue over whether that extra squiggle of ink changes anything. But no, fundamentally, it is materially identical to what I just handed you. But it is, especially now that we do it online, you know, and just sort of click to say, you know, click to sign kind of stuff. But people before presented a contract, like read it out in court, but they both agreed in front of a judge and, you know, nothing happened to the paper itself, but it still created a contract at that moment. And that is, again, very much like the marriage case. And these things change fundamentally in the very essence and nature. And I think anyone who's been married, truly married with this commitment, understands that as soon as you say, I do, something does change. Metaphysically, something changes. You are a different person from that moment. So we have in these very reserved places moments where the materiality does not change, but the essence, the substance of the thing does. And so again, given all the scriptural evidence, given the early church fathers, I just want to share this real presence view of the sacraments to people, because I think it's one of the greatest gifts. The Eucharist especially is probably the single greatest gift I feel I've been given as a Catholic. Like, beautiful church architecture, wonderful history.
Right.
You know, all these things exist elsewhere. The Eucharist exists nowhere else. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good pitch. What? Yeah. All right. So this is the last thing that I wanted to ask you about, and then we'll wrap it up. One thing that I've come across, I came across it in this book by Dr. Sockold, and I've come across a few different places, is I guess you could call it like attempted ecumenism by either attempted ecumenism by recovering definitions, or if you're skeptical of the person that's presenting it, by redefinition, right? If it's a group that's trying to make this same move and you think it's not warranted, then I guess it would be redefinition. But I wonder if you think that is, or I guess I wonder how far that could take us. Like, so Dr. Sockold in this book is going to say the reformers didn't understand transubstantiation. It's not entirely their fault because of the nominalism that was just part of the academic culture of the time. So not entirely their fault, but they misunderstood it. And so if they had understood it correctly, maybe there wouldn't have been a disagreement. And maybe today, when Protestants, Eastern Orthodox, other churches, and the Roman Catholic Church understand what we're all saying, then we can come to an agreement on these things. And like, I would love there to be more as a layperson who has friends in different traditions, would love for that to be the case. I wonder how much of that is fruitful and how much of it is just playing too fast and loose with history. I wondered if you had a thought on that.
I'm not sure this will really answer your question, but I should start by saying, according to the Catholic Church, I am absolutely permitted to take communion at an Orthodox church. We see what the Orthodox churches are doing as not even fundamentally, just the same. You know, they are two churches, just not in communion with Rome, which means they have some differences of doctrine, but they are still, the sacraments are valid. So, for example, when a Orthodox priest, or a Anglican priest for that matter, converts, they have been properly made a priest. And so they do not have to, there's a blessing that goes along with it. I don't know the exact details, so I actually should even walk back. They've been properly made a priest. To my understanding, they have. Because of course, how could you perform the Eucharist without doing so? And this might be a little wonky now with the Anglicans, as they're getting wonkier, because of course the ordination of women is invalid, and so that will change things. So set the Anglicans aside, and But when Anglican, there's a whole ordinance is what we call it, of former Anglican priests who have families and are Roman Catholic priests because they've converted in to the faith. Same with, Orthodox who convert in who have families. They are valid priests with families because celibacy is not a moral requirement. It's a legal requirement of the priesthood at this point. Having families and then giving partiality to the families was just becoming too much of a hassle in the late medieval church, and so they codified the rule. Now both Eastern Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church have always held that you had to be celibate to be a bishop, but that's a separate thing. I'm going way too long-winded on this because this is tangential to my point. I just wanted to point out that the Orthodox are the ones standing in the way, at least, of Catholics receiving the Eucharist at an Orthodox divine liturgy. In all of the senses, according to the Catholic Church, they're valid sacraments, and we could receive them. Some sacraments in other churches, this is true for as well. So, as far as I know, not the Eucharist in any other church,
Baptism.
But baptism, exactly. Yes. So, so long as you are baptized with water, and you are baptized in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and you believe the same thing about the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit that Catholics do. So Mormons are excluded because of that requirement, because they believe they're three different people. And forgive me, Mormons, if I'm not getting that exactly right.
yeah. As far as I know.
So long as you have that presupposition of the Trinitarian theology and being blessed with water in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, you are properly baptized according to Catholics, even if the person who baptized you is not a bishop or not a priest or, you know, it is not licit, that is, it's not legal if you are a Catholic to, you know, baptize your own children. Except for an emergency, but it is sacramentally valid. And again, this is the sort of thing that makes Orthodox heads explode of Eastern Orthodox, and I understand why. But it also is I think an important and useful distinction in this case.
They have their own version for that one.
Yeah,
for baptisms, if you convert to Eastern Orthodoxy, then that's like a confirmation that your baptism was real. But so in effect it's the same, but they will say like my baptism is currently not a valid baptism.
Well, and I know even with Catholics they have a sort of a hot and cold. One of the things is from a Catholic perspective, we look at the Eastern Orthodox and say, how are you one church? Because you're just sort of a set of different churches who are, you know, sometimes with mutually compatible sacraments, you know, because currently I think the Ukrainian East Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church aren't in communion with each other. I don't think the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, and again, Eastern Orthodox, I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong. I'm not trying to I'm certainly not trying to pronounce definitively on your faith. I'm not even trying to pronounce definitively on mine. it's just, I'm trying to explain the differences is, you know, so my point with that is that I have heard that some Eastern Orthodox churches will just basically allow a Catholic to step right in and start receiving sacraments. Some, they have to go through the equivalent of whatever the equivalent of our OCIA is, our initiation of Christian into the Christian faith. And they will sometimes even rebaptize you, even though, and again, Catholics, like most Christians, most Trinitarian Christians who walk into a Catholic church are just going to be received in with confirmation, not with a rebaptism. Mm. So
got it.
Your question, though, wasn't really about that. Your question was about how I think these things, you know, if we're sort of molding the Reformation to get this idea that if we all just understood each other, we could get along. I think that's a very comforting idea, but, and I think it's a very modern idea. The idea that if we just all understood each other, we'd all want the same things. Like, people really don't want the same things. Even within our own society, they don't want the same things. And certainly across societies, they don't. And so, now it's possible, you know, I've heard some Catholics say that the Reformation was all political. And if you think it's all political, then yeah, if we just agreed about things, then we would agree. but I don't know. You are really the one to tell me more than I'm to tell you. I'm the Catholic here. You know, it seems, I'm assuming most people who broke away, or at least some people who broke away from the Catholic Church, were not just doing it because they didn't like listening to priests, or because they didn't like the celibacy rules, or because a priest was mean. Like, this is a real decision that really matters. And I just know too many seriously devout and honest Protestants to really take that position too seriously. I mean, it's true. Maybe if we all agree, again, if we all agreed, we'd all agree. But like, I think there seems, again, you should tell me, but there seems to be some real disagreement there, not just arguing over the definition of words.
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't look for anything in our lifetimes. To really change. I think it's interesting. I guess I'm skeptical of some applications of that approach that I've come across, but I think it is an interesting path to go down of hammering away at definitions I don't know. I'm interested to continue listening into those kinds of discussions.
Well, if nothing else, we understand each other better, and what we mean when we have these conversations, and that itself is very useful. And just useful, that sounds, you know, materialistic again. It's very, it is good for us, as I said earlier, even if we disagree, it's good for us to better understand each other and better understand our own meaning, and what we mean by our words and what we mean by our actions and all of that. I'm now sounding like an infomercial, I feel.
No, it's good.
Understand yourself. Be true to yourself.
Really enjoyed the conversation, as always, Judd.
Yes, thank you
for coming on.
No, thank you.
What can we plug for you again? Yes. Your website?
Yes. It's very, very easy to remember. JuddBaroff.com. And so, you know, so long as you take a look at my name in the show notes, you'll be able to find me on the web. And then also, it's the same. It's Twitter, or I guess now X/ Judd Baroff. And so fairly straightforward. No spaces in either of those. Capitalization doesn't matter.
I'll put links to both those in the show notes. And yeah, follow Judd for the stuff that he's writing and coming out with.
I have an article coming out soon with the Vital Senna, sort of center-right magazine about education. And so,
very good.
It sort of dovetails with stuff I know Brian talks about fairly regularly. Well, I don't know how regularly, but the recent podcast I really enjoyed, you and Richard Rowland. So,
Yeah, that was fun. Okay, yeah, definitely. I'm sure you'll share that when that's out. And I'll probably see it come across on somewhere that I'm keeping tabs on you. But definitely send that one over if it somehow slips past me.
Sure thing.
All right. Well, I hope you have a great night, and we'll have to figure out what we want to do next time. Maybe we'll do a follow up like I did with Deacon Roland, and we can talk about education, or we can talk about books or something lower stakes than transubstantiation. Maybe next time.
Well, I won't run out of information if we talk about books. So, thanks again, Brian.